Good day. Today is Wednesday, 19th November 2025. And before I proceed with this video, let me quickly remind you to tick the like button if once you've watched and listened to the video or whatever part of the video you want to watch and listen to, you have liked what you have heard and you want to indicate that fact. Let me now turn to the events in Ukraine, which are becoming increasingly dramatic. In fact, it's perhaps an overstatement to say that we are looking at a political implosion in Kiev. But then again, perhaps not. There are lots and lots of rumours swirling around. And certainly the political crisis in Kiev seems to be deepening all the time. Now, let's first of all begin with Rustem Umerov, former defense minister of Ukraine, currently secretary of Ukraine's National Defense and Security Council. He still occupies that post. A couple of days ago, after there were reports that the anti-corruption investigators from NABU and SAPO wanted to meet with him. There were reports that he'd left Ukraine, apparently, or some claimed, in order to avoid meeting with these investigators and perhaps being arrested by them. He then went to Istanbul. The story was that he was going to restart negotiations with the Russians in order to arrange a prisoner swap. The Russians said that they had absolutely no understanding or knowledge of any such outreach by Umerov or anyone else in Ukraine, at least to them. But anyway, Umerov said that he was going to Istanbul for that purpose. Then he left Turkey completely, entirely. Reports said that he'd flown to the Gulf, to the UAE and to Qatar. And I pointed out that the UAE in particular is an interesting location because it is an important financial centre. Dubai is absolutely now a world financial centre. And, well, there are lots of banks in Dubai and lots of interesting people have accounts there. Anyway, after that, we heard little more about Umerov, except that reports were circulating yesterday that he had contacted Zelensky and informed Zelensky that he did not intend to return to Ukraine. Now, earlier today, I came across more reports that are circulating in Kiev, but which I also believe are being picked up by some people in the US, that Umerov is now actually in the US and that he is in contact with the FBI and that he is apparently providing the FBI information concerning corruption in Ukraine. Allegedly, he has also applied for political asylum in the United States. Now, I want to make it very clear here, right away, that these are all rumours. I've not seen any confirmation of any of this from any official Ukrainian source. But, just to say, I have not heard of any denials either. Then, a few hours ago, reports also circulated that another senior Ukrainian official, Svetlana Grinchuk, who is Ukraine's energy minister, has also left Ukraine. Well, I say left Ukraine. Ukrainian reports say that she has actually fled Ukraine. She appears to be following behind Umerov, and it will be interesting to see where exactly she is going. So, the former defense minister, who is still nominally the secretary of Ukraine's National Defence and Security Council, and the energy minister, two of the most important officials, in other words, within the governmental structure in Ukraine. Anyway, they appear, according to the rumours, to have fled the country. Now, yesterday, reports were also circulating in Kiev that a far more important individual than either of these two individuals was also on the verge of losing his position. And this is Zelensky's all-powerful chief of staff, Andrei Yermak, a Ukrainian MP, Goncharenko, who is an important person, at least he's a highly visible person in Ukrainian politics, said that Zelensky had had certain meetings over the course of the previous couple of days, that he'd met one particular official and had informed her that he was on the brink of dismissing Yermak from his position as chief of staff and was intending to appoint this other official in his place instead. And reports also circulated yesterday that Yermak was also on his way to Turkey to meet this time with Donald Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, and that the two were supposed to discuss, well, at that point when those reports appeared, it was not at all clear what it was exactly that they were supposed to discuss. Anyway, then further reports started to appear that Witkoff was in fact refusing to meet Yermak and that he was insisting on meeting Zelensky instead. Anyway, a few hours later, reports circulated, in fact, wasn't reports, confirmation appeared that Zelensky himself is flying to Turkey to meet Witkoff there, to meet Witkoff in Istanbul. And Zelensky says that this is all about getting talks with the Russians restarted. The very thing that Umerov was telling us he was going to Istanbul to do just a few days ago. And all very interesting, given that last week, Ukraine's deputy foreign minister, in an interview to the London Times, said that Ukraine had suspended all talks and negotiations with the Russians until the end of the year. Well, that was last week, but now Zelensky's flying to Istanbul to meet Witkoff, supposedly in order to get the talks restarted. And then a short time later, Yermak posted a message on X saying that he's also going to Istanbul. He's going to Istanbul after all, where he will in fact be meeting Witkoff, but will be doing so as a member of Zelensky's delegation. So where exactly all this leaves Yermak, I'm not able to say. But anyway, there are rumours flying around that his position is now in jeopardy. And Events in Ukraine, that invaluable blog, which keeps its finger on the pulse of what is going on in Ukraine. Anyway, it's now published a long and very interesting piece, including extracts of an interview given by another Ukrainian MP, a member of Zelensky's own party, who says that he absolutely does want Yermak to go, and that this is the general opinion of the majority of the MPs in the parliament who belong to Zelensky's party. So I'm not saying it's the end of Yermak, but certainly there are rumours and speculations about him. And then just a short time ago, reports also circulated that the parliament has dismissed the Minister of Justice of Ukraine, German Galushenko. He has been dismissed, and we're told that more people are due to step down, and that there is now talk on the part of the Ukrainian opposition, in other words, of people like Poroshenko and Klitschko and Tymoshenko, that the moment has now come, in this moment of supreme crisis, for some kind of government of national unity to be formed. Now, again, there is a lot of rumour and speculation here. I should say, and I ought to have said, that the rumours about Umerov and his, well, I won't say defection, but anyway, disappearance, have been fed by none other than Mariana Bezuglaya. She is one of the people who's now coming out and saying that Umerov has indeed fled the country and has fled to the United States and is intending to claim political asylum there, or at least that he has told Zelensky that he is not coming back. So anyway, clearly something is going on in Kiev, even if some of these rumours are untrue. Well, the very fact that they are circulating to the extent that they are at all is giving us, it gives a sense that the situation is becoming extremely fragile and that the political crisis is deepening, and that for the first time since the beginning of the special military operation, the start of the war in February 2022, it does look as if Zelensky is facing a real concerted challenge to his authority. Now, there are other rumours circulating as well. One rumour is that before joining Zelensky on his trip to Turkey to meet with Witkoff, Yermak flew to London, where he had a meeting with Ukraine's ambassador to Britain, who is, of course, none other than Valery Zaluzhny, the general who previously commanded Ukraine's armed forces. So, as I said, lots of rumours, lots of speculations, lots of questions. One question which nobody is asking, but which does puzzle me, is why exactly is Witkoff meeting all of these people, Zelensky and presumably Yermak, in Turkey and not in Kiev? Why exactly has the meeting been arranged in Istanbul, except in Kiev, where Zelensky ought to be? Could it be because, to American annoyance, Zelensky himself has left Kiev and has gone on this extraordinary tour of Europe, which I discussed yesterday, the one with the fantastic and fictitious deals, the deal with the Greeks about liquefied natural gas to be imported to Ukraine through Greek ports, the bizarre deal, the extraordinary deal to buy 100 Rafale fighter jets from France. This a couple of weeks after Zelensky apparently also agreed to buy 150 Gripen fighter jets from Sweden. In Britain, the journalist Owen Matthews, who'd previously been a supporter, I think it's fair to say, of Zelensky's, or at least somebody who had a lot of time for Zelensky, and certainly somebody who is very supportive of Ukraine overall. Anyway, Owen Matthews has now published another article in the Daily Telegraph, which straightforwardly says, the title reads, that Zelensky has lost touch with reality, which is what I'm saying. Anyway, we've had this extraordinary road trip that Zelensky has been engaged in. And, well, you would have expected that the Americans would want to meet him in Kiev. But no, he wants to go to Turkey, or at least the meeting is going to happen in Turkey instead. He's not returning to Kiev to meet Witkoff there. He's decided that he and Yermak are going to meet Witkoff in Turkey. So why is Witkoff wanting to meet them in Turkey rather than in Kiev? Could it be that someone in Washington is now worried that with a deteriorating military situation, travel to Kiev itself is becoming unsafe? I mean, it would be a reason. But then, adding to the mystery, there are lots of reports circulating that a high-level American military delegation is currently in Kiev. And apparently it's coming to discuss the prospects of peace in Ukraine. Now, why do you need to send a military delegation to Kiev to discuss diplomacy? Surely that's the job of diplomats. And I'm not quite sure myself who exactly is involved in this military delegation. And whom are they going to meet, given that all of the top people, Zelensky, Yermak, presumably Umerov, who was, after all, or to be more precise, nominally still is, Secretary of Ukraine's National Defense and Security Council, are no longer in Kiev to meet with them? Are they going to be Basirsky? Are they going to meet with the current defense minister? Are they going to be, who exactly are they going to be talking to? Adding to this, the mystery about this delegation, and as far as I am concerned, it is a mystery. There are also reports circulating that this same American military delegation, after it leaves Kiev, is going to travel to Moscow. To meet whom precisely? Shoigu, the Secretary of Russia's Security Council, the man the FSB and the Russian media are alleging Ukraine tried to assassinate, the man who was previously Russia's defense minister. Since I mentioned Shoigu, perhaps I should quickly correct an error that I made in my program yesterday. I refer to him as General of the Army, Shoigu. It's been explained to me by a source in Russia that this is a purely honorific title. It does not mean that Shoigu is actually a serving officer of the Russian army, or that he is considered by the military itself to be a military official. It does come with a uniform, apparently, and a title, but comments that he's a general who's never served in the military might be a bit ungenerous in terms of what this title really amounts to. But anyway, is this military delegation going to meet him? Is this going to meet with the current Russian defense minister, Andrei Belousov? Is he going to meet with the chief of the general staff, Valery Gerasimov, who is, of course, the overall military commander of the Russian forces in Ukraine? Is it going to meet with Putin and Lavrov? Is it even going at all? All very mysterious and all very unclear. But anyway, coming back to the fact that this meeting is taking place in Istanbul, the meeting between Zelensky and perhaps Yermak and Witkoff is taking place in Istanbul. I can't help but think that there is some significance to this, that the Americans, that the top American political leadership is in effect summoning Zelensky and Yermak to a meeting, and that they're underlining the fact that the meeting is not going to happen on Ukrainian territory. In other words, on Zelensky's home turf. They want it to take place in the capital of a NATO country, which is also an ally of the United States, and which has also been assisting the various very confused and contradictory steps the United States has been taking to try to bring about some kind of settlement to the conflict in Ukraine. Anyway, lots of rumours, lots of speculation, but it's difficult to avoid the sense that some kind of meltdown in Kiev, political meltdown in Kiev, is taking place. Now, there has been a very interesting article in Axios, which all but says that the Trump administration, or at least some people in the Trump administration, are now making a serious attempt to restart dialogue with Moscow in order to see whether some kind of settlement of the crisis in Ukraine can be achieved after all. And there is good reason to think, in fact, there's excellent reason to think, that this article is fact-based, because it's clear that one of the sources, one of the key sources for this article, is none other than Kirill Dmitriev, the head of Russia's Direct Investment Fund, who has been Putin's envoy in meetings with Witkoff and Dmitriev forming the back channel through which the Russians and the Americans, the Putin government and the Trump administration have been conducting their discussions. And, well, it's very interesting to read this article. The article quotes Dmitriev as saying this: Dmitriev told Axios the basic idea was to take the principles Trump and Russian President Putin agreed in Alaska in August and produce a proposal to address the Ukrainian conflict, but also how to restore US-Russia ties and address Russia's security concerns. It's actually a much broader framework, basically saying, how do we really bring, finally, lasting security to Europe, not just Ukraine? The aim is to produce a written document along those lines before Trump and Putin next meet, according to Dmitriev. Plans for a Budapest summit between the leaders remain on hold for now. And then we are told that the draft, that this document that Witkoff and Dmitriev are working on, bears no relation at all to the British-led push for a peace plan for Ukraine. In fact, there were reports about 2 weeks ago that such a plan was indeed being worked on by the British government and by other European governments. And Axios says that Dmitriev has told them that such plan, the British plan, had no chance of success because it disregards Russia's position. And Dmitriev then goes on to say, the US side is now in the process of explaining the benefits of its current approach to the Ukrainians and the Europeans. It's happening, and this is a direct quote from Dmitriev, it's happening with the background of Russia definitely having additional successes on the battlefield. And Axios says that Dmitriev contended that Moscow's leverage is growing. Anyway, that's Dmitriev. We are then told that Axios has spoken to a US official who confirmed that the White House has started briefing European officials about the new plan. And the official, who might be Witkoff, or perhaps it might be someone else, I'm not going to try and make any guesses. The official said the White House thinks there's a real chance of getting the Europeans and Ukrainians on board, and the plan would be adapted based on input from the various parties, which, frankly, is a good reason to think that it's going to be stillborn. Because based on what I can see about this plan in Axios, the Europeans and the Ukrainians, including the Ukrainians who are currently plotting against Yermak and perhaps Zelensky in Kiev, are not going to like it at all. Anyway, to continue, the keywords, the absolutely essential points about this plan is what Dmitriev says about it. He has said that the plan, it takes the principles Trump and Putin agreed to in Alaska in August. And in fact, I understand, I think it was Peskov actually, said yesterday that the Russians have made it clear to the Americans that the only way forward now is for the Americans to return to what Trump and Putin agreed in Alaska. Now, I've discussed that extensively. We've had this cascade of interviews and press conferences provided by Lavrov. And I said that the final clarity about the Putin-Trump understanding, which was reached in Alaska, was provided by Lavrov's interview to the Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera, the interview which Corriere della Sera has not published in full. And we now know from that interview that what happened in Alaska was that Trump effectively, essentially, accepted Putin's June 2024 demands for the ending of the war, in effect, Istanbul Plus. And if you go to the Axios article, we are essentially told this. We're told that it's a 28-point plan, that it's supposedly inspired by President Trump's successful push for a deal in Gaza. That is, of course, absolute nonsense. There is no, well, we'll talk about Gaza another time, but I'm not going to waste time muddling the issue in this programme by talking about Gaza. But anyway, we're told that the 28 points fall into four buckets, and that one of these involve peace in Ukraine, security guarantees, security in Europe, and future US relations with Russia and Ukraine. And we are also told, by Dmitriev himself, of course, that the plan is not just about Ukraine, but about peace in Europe. And it, in fact, appears to involve a major reconsideration of the entire security architecture in Europe. And I discussed in many programs, based on comments that Lavrov has made, that the Russians at least came away from the meeting in Alaska convinced that Trump had indicated some kind of agreement to Russian requests or demands for a review, a renegotiation of the security architecture in Europe. And I've also said in many programs that I don't believe in reality that the Trump administration, that Donald Trump himself, is ever actually going to agree to that. But anyway, this seems to be in this proposal that Witkoff and Dmitriev are working on with each other. Now, where does all this go? Is there any reality to any of this? Now, I'm going to say straight away that it's impossible by this point not to have serious doubts. Dmitriev, in this article, in this interview he's given Axios, all but confirms, in fact does confirm, that what has changed the entire atmosphere is the changes of the situation on the ground. The Russian advance, the fact that the Russians are on the brink of their great breakthrough in Donbass, that the Russians are advancing faster and faster in Zaporozhye region, that there is a burgeoning crisis in Kharkiv region, that the Russians are hammering Ukraine every day and every night, and are pounding Ukraine's energy system to pieces, that there is a major funding crisis for Ukraine with a $60 billion hole in Ukraine's budget, which the Europeans for the moment seem unable to fill. It's clearly all of these different things that have come together and which are pushing some people in Washington to revisit these ideas, to revisit Alaska, and to come back to what was agreed there. But I'm far from convinced that everybody in Washington is going to agree to this. What real prospect is there that the United States is ever going to agree to a substantial reordering of the security architecture in Europe? The Russians have been talking about this since the 1990s, indeed since before the USSR collapsed, and the United States has never really engaged and has never shown much interest. And I get the sense sometimes that American officials don't even really understand that the Russians are serious about talking about this question. I don't believe the United States is going to do that, do anything like this. And, well, if we go back to what happened in the summer, Witkoff came to Moscow, apparently told the Russians that Trump was in agreement basically with Istanbul Plus. Lavrov has confirmed this in the interview he gave to Corriere della Sera, which I discussed in my program yesterday. Witkoff did propose some amendments. He suggested that the Russians agree to stop in Zaporozhye and Kherson region, though he accepted that the Ukrainians would have to withdraw completely from Donbass before a cessation of hostilities, let's use that word rather than ceasefire, came into effect. But it's clear that Witkoff was prepared to accept Istanbul Plus. And based on what Lavrov said to Corriere della Sera, that included the eventual transfer of the entirety of Zaporozhye and Kherson regions to Russia. The problem was that though Witkoff has no problem with this, and one senses that deep down, Trump himself has no problem with this either. This is completely unacceptable in Europe. It is almost certainly unacceptable with the political class in Kiev, with Poroshenko and Timoshenko, I suspect, as much as it is unacceptable for Zelensky himself. And it is going to be totally unacceptable in Europe. We already see that the British and the Europeans have their own alternative plan. Dmitriev says that plan has no prospect of success because it is totally unacceptable to Moscow. But when, at any point in this crisis, has that ever influenced the Europeans in any way? Just saying. So, if this is a discussion being conducted purely between Dmitriev and Witkoff, well, these two, very worthy, hard-working, I would say, you know, reputable gentlemen, people, have come up with all sorts of interesting ideas and plans. They've all both been, shall we say, very good friends with each other. They've conducted a sane and rational dialogue as people from the business world trying to deal with these intractable questions might be expected to do. But to the hard people in the deep state, the national security state in the United States, to the leaders of Europe, to the leaders both present and future of Ukraine, I can't help but think that all of this is going to be completely unacceptable. And in fact, we have all of the moves, all of the signals coming from the United States, which point in the diametrically opposite direction. Now, last night, there was a missile strike on Russia, on the city of Voronezh, to be precise. And the most important thing about that particular missile strike is that it was conducted using American ATACMS missiles. The Russian Defense Ministry has provided a detailed account of this strike. Russian armed forces repel ATACMS missile strike on Voronezh on 18th November 2025 at 14:31 Moscow time. The Kiev regime attempted to launch a missile strike against civilian objects in the depth of the territory of the Russian Federation. Four US-made ATACMS operational tactical missiles were launched by the enemy against the city of Voronezh. During the anti-missile battle, Russian S-400 surface-to-air systems and Pantsir anti-aircraft missile systems shot down all the ATACMS missiles. Falling debris from the destroyed missiles damaged the roofs of the Voronezh Regional Geriatric Centre and an orphanage, as well as one private house. There are no casualties or injured amongst civilians. Russian air reconnaissance systems promptly identified the location of the ATACMS launchers in Kharkiv region. Two US-made multiple launch rocket systems were detected near Voloskaya Balaklaya, 50 kilometers south of Chuguyev. An Iskander-M system launched a missile strike against the Ukrainian missile position, which destroyed the two multiple launch rocket system launchers, along with ammunition and up to 10 servicemen of the crew. Now, this is the Russian Defense Ministry's account of this missile strike. And I will say straight away that I believe every part of it. I believe that there was a strike on Voronezh. I accept that the four ATACMS missiles were used. I have no reason to doubt that the Russians managed to detect and shoot down each one of these missiles, and that they were also able to work out what the launch position of these missiles was, that they conducted a counter-strike using Iskander-M missiles, that the two launchers that launched these attack-ups missiles were destroyed, and the 10 Ukrainian servicemen were either killed or severely wounded as a result. So absolutely, this was a failed strike by Ukraine on the Russian city of Voronezh with attack-ups missiles. It didn't achieve anything. All it achieved was in the destruction of two HIMARS launch vehicles and 10, and the killing or wounding of 10 Ukrainian servicemen. But the key point is, I said that this is a Ukrainian strike on Voronezh, but everybody, including President Putin himself, have said many times, and it has been confirmed in the US media, that ATACMS missiles cannot be used without input by the United States itself. The United States must provide targeting and guidance for these missiles. This is the first instance, to my knowledge, of ATACMS missiles being used for a strike against targets in pre-2014 Russia, since President Trump became president of the United States again in January, which has been confirmed by the Russian Defense Ministry. Now, how does that square with attempts being made by the Trump administration to negotiate peace with Moscow? To me, and to many people in Moscow, it is going to look completely contradictory. And of course, just 2 days ago, we had President Trump himself say that he now backs Lindsey Graham's and Richard Blumenthal's massive sanctions bill, which will impose huge tariffs on and sanctions against countries that conduct any sort of business with Russia. Lindsey Graham has leapt forward on the following Trump's words. He says that he now has the backing of the president, and all of the indications are that this massive sanctions bill is now being reactivated. And, well, a few hours later, we got reports from the Trump administration that they were trying to push back a bit. They were saying, as they, by the way, also said in the summer when this bill was being talked about then, that, yes, Trump does back this bill, but only on the condition that the final decision on whether or not to impose sanctions is left up to him, and that he should have complete freedom, presumably both to impose the sanctions and then to cancel them. Anyway, so there are still unresolved issues about this. But, well, for all that, I can't imagine that people in Moscow are going to fail to see this as anything other than an unfriendly act. Now, going back to what Peskov, Putin's spokesman, said yesterday, I want to repeat it again. Peskov said that the Americans might be meeting with the Turks. The Americans and the Turks in Turkey might be meeting with the Ukrainians. But nobody has so far reached out to the Russians. There's no word that the Russians have been invited so far. No new proposals have been put to them. No fresh ideas have come out of Kiev. For the moment at least, official Moscow undoubtedly is aware of the discussions going on between Witkov and Dmitriev, but they're not going to let themselves be drawn in again. They're waiting to see what the Americans and the Ukrainians are going to do. So Witkoff and Dmitriev might indeed come up with a plan, but this time, before the Russians, I suspect, are even going to consider it, they will want definite assurances from the Americans that the United States this time backs it, that what happened back in August in Alaska, when Putin came along believing that he had an American agreement to Istanbul Plus, only to find afterwards that that was far from being the case, that that isn't going to repeat itself again. So anyway, let us not get overexcited by this. I emphatically am not doing so. Istanbul Plus, anyway, is probably being overtaken, and overtaken fast, by events on the ground. Going back to that article by Jennifer Kavanagh in Responsible Statecraft that I discussed yesterday, yes, if the United States, if Trump, if the administration is really prepared to make concrete proposals to the Russians about the security architecture in Europe, a genuine restructuring of the security architecture in Europe, then perhaps, just possibly, I might take this process seriously. But I have my doubts, to put it mildly, and until those doubts are assuaged, my scepticism about where this is going will remain. Now, I would just finish by saying that the one thing that gives me pause is this mystery about this military delegation that is supposed to be in Kiev and about what it is actually about. My guess is that the real purpose of this delegation is not to discuss peace in Ukraine, but to try to find out from the Ukrainians what the true state of the war is. The Ukrainians have been telling the United States and the Europeans for months that they had the situation fully under control, that Russia's summer offensive had been a failure, that Russian losses were 10 times greater than Ukrainian losses, that the Russians were making no progress on the battlefronts, that Putin was stuck, and that Russia was bogged down. And now, suddenly, we learn of Ukrainian troops surrounded in Pokrovsk and Kupiansk. We're getting reports of a crisis in Zaporozhye and Dnipropetrovsk region. There is a crisis in Siversk. The energy system appears to be collapsing. It looks, on the contrary, as if everything is going wrong. And the Americans probably want answers. They want to find out what the true situation is. Why they bothered, why they ever made the mistake of accepting what the Ukrainians were telling them, will forever remain, for me, a mystery. And I would have thought that if you go to all the proper sites, and there are many of them, I look at them all the time, it's actually not very difficult to find what the basic military situation is. But the Americans still are stuck trying to find out exactly, to try to get the picture about the war from the Ukrainians rather than from anyone else. And I suspect, given how deep in the Ukrainians now are, that they will continue the usual practice. They will tell the Americans, actually, yes, things are not quite as good as we believed or said they were a few weeks ago, but they're not really as bad as you're being told. They will spin another story. And based on everything I've seen in the past, the Americans will be satisfied with that, and they will go back to Washington, and they will tell Kellogg and General Kane at the chief at the Joint Chiefs of Staff that actually, despite things being less good than they seemed, the Ukrainians overall are still holding on, and that they still have the situation under control. If the rumours are true and this military delegation does indeed go to Moscow, then that will be a sign that things really are changing. And that will be the moment when I take this whole diplomatic process, such as it is, seriously. Now, that does not change the fact that, as I said, we are seeing a crisis in Kiev. And the reason we are seeing a crisis in Kiev is because on the battlefronts, Ukraine is collapsing. That is why there is this sudden conflict in Kiev. That is why there is talk of ousting Yermak. That is why all of these people are busy feverishly manoeuvring around each other. There is perhaps on the part of some people in Kiev still a desperate hope that if the deck chairs on the sinking ship are rearranged, that will stop the ship from sinking. But I suspect that these hard people in Kiev, most of them, they're making these moves because, as I said, they want to get closer to the money flow before it stops, so that like Umarov and the energy minister, and before long, I expect more and more others, they can leave in the confident knowledge that the bank accounts are waiting for them and that the suitcases that they travel with are well provided with cash. I am sorry if this all sounds cynical, but by now, I have long since come to the view that the most cynical interpretation of what is happening in Kiev is always and invariably the most accurate one. Anyway, as the rats give every impression of scuttling off the sinking ship, because that, I suspect, is what's actually going on, let's discuss how the ship is sinking. Well, even as the United States and Ukraine conducted an ineffective missile strike against the Russian city of Voronezh, the Russians continue to pound Ukraine with missiles and drones. Here is the Russian Defense Ministry's account of what happened. In response to Ukraine's terrorist attacks against civilian facilities in Russia this morning, the armed forces of the Russian Federation carried out a massive strike with long-range air and sea-based high-precision weapons, including Kinzhal hypersonic air-launched ballistic missiles, attack drones against the defense industry and power facilities that support their continued work, as well as long-range unmanned aerial vehicle depots in western regions of Ukraine. The goals of the strike have been achieved. All the assigned targets have been hit. And we can disregard the claim about the fact that this is a response to Ukraine's terrorist attacks against civilian facilities in Russia. As I've said many times, everything about these Russian missile strikes points to the attacks being thoroughly planned in advance and as part of an ongoing campaign against Ukraine conducted by Russia in the sky. Now, the Defence Ministry, the Russian Defence Ministry, has said that sea-launched missiles were used. I understand these were Kalibr subsonic missiles launched from the Black Sea by the Russian Black Sea Fleet. They also confirmed that Kinjal missiles were used. The Kinjals have now become regular missiles routinely used by the Russians in their various missile strikes. Clearly, a big stockpile of Kinjal missiles has now been created in Russia. And obviously, production of Kinjal missiles is now high enough that the Russians can feel that they can sustain that stockpile through the continuous launch of these missiles. But a lot of other missiles were used as well. Iskander-M missiles launched from the ground, KH-101s launched by Russian bombers, Tupolev F-95s mostly, apparently. But there are some reports that Russian Tupolev F-160 supersonic strategic bombers also participated in this strike. And interestingly, reports also claim the Tupolev 22M3 medium-range strategic bombers launching the gigantic and extremely powerful supersonic KH-22-32 missiles which Ukraine has previously admitted it has great difficulty intercepting, that they were launched as well. So a massive strikes. The Ukrainians say 48 missiles altogether. That's their claim. We don't know how many of these missiles were shot down, if any were, just saying. The Ukrainians no doubt will claim that many of them were, but I don't yet know the figures. And Ukraine also claims, I believe, that something like 470 drones, Geran drones, were launched as well. The targets appear to have been all across Ukraine. Lviv in the west was struck. So were other places all across Ukraine. There are lots of pictures of places of burning buildings and damage and sirens and all of that. But only tomorrow will I be able to give a clear assessment, or at least a partial assessment, of how effective this strike has been. But I have no doubt, based on everything we know, that the strike has indeed been extremely effective. Now, there has also been a lot of news from the battlefronts. And let's begin with Zaporozhye region. The Russians appear to be continuing their advance in Zaporozhye region. More villages and settlements are falling under Russian control in Zaporozhye and Dnipropetrovsk regions. Ukrainian attempts to create defense lines in Zaporozhye region seem to fail almost as soon as they start. We're looking at an escalating and indeed accelerating collapse there. And there's also been reports that closer to the Dnieper, in the village of Stepnogorsk, in the town rather of Stepnogorsk, the Russians are now in control of the central areas of Stepnogorsk. In Dnipropetrovsk region, the Ukrainians, about a day or so ago, claimed that they had successfully pushed the Russians back in the town of Novopavlivka, and a lot of people believe that to be true. But video footage released by the Ukrainians themselves tells a totally different story. It looks as if the claims that the Russians are in control of 80% of Novopavlivka are true. And I expect that that entire town is going to pass fully under Russian control, probably in the next few hours rather than days. And there is supposedly already fighting going on in the other town of Velikomikhailovka, but I don't have the exact details. Now, a few days ago, Redovka, the Russian newspaper in Smolensk, which, as I said, gives fairly accurate descriptions of the nature of the fighting. Anyway, Redovka was claiming that the end point of the battle in Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, had been reached, that the Ukrainians were making a final attempt to break through to their encircled forces in Mirnograd, and that they were trying to capture the town of Rodinska, that their attacks on an increasingly narrow front were making it, however, easier for the Russians to counter them. And, well, today, the reports of Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, appear to suggest that whatever counterattacks the Ukrainians were conducting in Rodinska have failed, because as far as I can see, and judged from what the Russian Defense Ministry is saying, the situation in the Pokrovsk cauldron continues to deteriorate, and the various mapping projects continue to show most of Rodinska firmly under Russian control. In fact, the mapping projects are now starting to colour the northern suburbs of Pokrovsk red, indicating that these are under Russian control. I ought to say that from the maps, my understanding is that most of these suburbs are not even built up. Places, they're largely wooded areas that are enclosed within the boundaries of the metropolitan boundaries of the town. There is still clearly a fair amount of clearing of pockets of resistance in Pokrovsk itself still going on. But it's clear an exercise now in clearing up these pockets. The town itself is evidently under Russian control. Mirnograd itself, as I've already said, the Ukrainians appear to be isolated in its northeastern territories. And the Russians are bombing the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd very heavily now. And I've noticed that they're using the giant Fab 3000 bombs. And, well, I shudder to think what the effect must be on any Ukrainian troops dug in the basements of the various shattered buildings who find themselves attacked by these enormous bombs. So that's Pokrovsk, Mirnograd. There's been less information from Kupiansk, but there has been some, and interestingly enough, the Russian commander in the area, one of the Russian commanders in the area, Lavrik, who is a detachment leader of the 121st Motorized Rifle Regiment of the Russian Army, has provided the Russian Defense Ministry with these comments. "We conduct reconnaissance and inflict fire damage on the enemy in the woods on the southern outskirts of the city. We thwart any movement of enemy troops. When mopping up basements in Kolontayevka, we found two abandoned large Ukrainian depots with weapons and ammunition. With the help of engineering units, we conduct mine action missions. Today, our drone operators detected enemy groups attempting to flee the wooded areas along the Oskol River. A group of 10 enemy troops were neutralized by American fire." I have no idea what neutralized means. I presume it means killed or wounded. I wish there would be more clarity about that, but well, perhaps that's asking rather too much. Now, notice that he is saying that the fighting is taking place in wooded areas. And that is consistent with what Lavrik and other Russian commanders in Kupiansk were saying last week, which is that it would take about a week to clear Kupiansk. It looks as if the Russians have completely cleared the Ukrainians out of the built-up areas in Kupiansk. Again, there might be some mopping up to do, but overall the Russians are in control of Kupiansk, including its industrial area east of the river, and the Ukrainians, to the extent that they have a presence in Kupiansk, rather like the situation in Pokrovsk, their presence is limited to wooded areas this time at the southern end of the town. So that's where such fighting has continues to take place in Kupiansk is still happening. Now, there has been a lot of news from other places, but the most dramatic news is coming from Siversk. And about a month ago, the Russian Defense Ministry, General Gerasimov himself, in fact, spoke about ongoing street fighting taking place in Siversk. This has never been acknowledged by any other source. But over the course of last night, most of the reliable mapping projects, Russian, some Ukrainian, and neutral Western, finally confirmed that there is indeed street fighting taking place in Siversk. Now, this may not be related to Gerasimov's earlier claims. It may be that those claims were untrue and that the Russians have only now finally broken into Siversk. Just saying, the fighting appears to be taking place in the southeastern section of Siversk, whereas I remember that Gerasimov, or rather his maps, seemed to be suggesting that it was taking place in the northeast corner of Siversk. So it's not exactly the same place. But anyway, regardless, there is now, I don't think, any longer any doubt that there is street fighting taking place inside Siversk. The Russians have broken in, and by some accounts, they now control around a quarter of the town. And there are pictures of Ukrainian troops trying to, walk across the cold and wet fields. The one film I have seen actually shows them in a section of the front southeast of Siversk, confusingly, southwest rather of Siversk. So I'm not quite sure what they're doing there. But it's been suggested that the Ukrainians, or at least some part of the Ukrainian garrison, is now starting to evacuate Siversk itself. Most of Siversk, about four-fifths of it, from what I can tell, and I'm not good at reading maps, lies to the east of a small river that bisects the town. This is the Bakhmutka River. There are some suggestions that the Ukrainians are going to try to make a stand on the west bank of the Bakhmutka River. But if they do, they can only hold their positions there, I would have thought, for a relatively short time. Yesterday, the Russian Defense Ministry claimed, in fact confirmed, I don't think anybody disputes it, apparently there's video footage which confirms it, that the Russians have captured a village called Platonovka, which lies to the west of Siversk. It's a village which is close, which cuts basically the main road to Siversk from the west, from Slavyansk. There are other roads further south, but the Russians apparently also have now drone control, at the very least, over those roads. And also, I understand that the more southern roads are only partially metalled. In other words, they have only partially an asphalt surface. And we're now in deep water, autumn, there's heavy rain. The condition of these roads at this time of year is too poor for them to be used to conduct supplies effectively. So, given that Siversk is a relatively small place, given that the Russians have broken into Siversk, given that they've apparently cleared the fortified positions around Siversk, I doubt that the battle for Siversk can last for very long. My guess is that probably by the beginning of next week, the Battle of Siversk will be over. And that will be a dramatic moment in the war. Siversk has defied every attempt up to now of the Russians to capture it since the spring of 2022. It has been a major thorn in Russia's side. The fall of Siversk, however, will almost certainly lead quickly to the capture by the Russians of Liman, recapture by the Russians of Liman. It's likely that the Russians will capture other places in this area as well. Sviatogorsk, for example, where there's the monastery. Maybe it'll enable the Russians to push beyond the Siversky-Donets River and capture other places closer to Slavyansk itself, Radnorok, and other places of that kind. The point is that one of the reasons why the Russian defences close to Slavyansk collapsed during Ukraine's counteroffensive in the autumn of 2022, why the Ukrainians were able to recapture rapidly Izium, Balaklaya, Liman, Stepnogorsk, all of these places, was, in my opinion, because the Russians at that time had failed to capture Siversk, and the result was that their entire front line in this area was based on an unstable foundation. With Siversk now soon under their control, with Kupiansk also, by the way, soon under their control too, with the Russians making further inroads in Kharkiv region, making it very likely that Russian attacks on Izium and Balaklaya are coming. Well, it's the situation is not going to repeat itself. The Russians are far stronger. Their positions around Slavyansk, north and east of Slavyansk, are going to be much stronger, and it's going to be impossible for the Ukrainians to repeat their success of autumn of 2022 and to push the Russians back. Just as Ukraine's positions in the south, in the southern line, in the southern area of this line of cities, the fortified cities, in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, and by the way, Konstantinovka too, is crumbling. The same is true in the north. This line of towns is like a great dam. It is held back for the last 4 years, the Russian flood, but that Russian flood is now growing to extraordinary strength, and the dam is cracking and will soon begin collapsing. And like what always happens when a dam breaks, the flood thereafter is going to be massive. So anyway, that is the situation as I see it today on the battlefronts. Lots of complicated manoeuvres taking place in Kiev, in the diplomacy, but it's the battlefronts, the situation on the battlefronts that drives things. It's the situation on the battlefronts that ultimately explains why European governments and the United States are now so frightened of providing Ukraine with further funding. It's why they're having doubts about expropriating the Russian assets, because the possibility of a Russian reparations loan, Russian reparations payments, always fictitious, in my opinion, now is fading into nothingness. It is also, by the way, why there is now a growing acknowledgement that the situation in Ukraine itself is unsustainable amongst many people in Kiev, and why Zelensky's political enemies or rivals in Kiev are now becoming more active, and why they're demanding their slice of the cake and are trying to push Zelensky's own people aside. I will finish with this last thing. Events in Ukraine, like myself, the blog Events in Ukraine, has always been sceptical, as I have been, about moves to push Zelensky himself aside. But I'm going to say this, if Yermak is indeed ousted as Zelensky's chief of staff over the next couple of days, then at that point, it would be appropriate to start to wonder how long Zelensky can cling on. Zelensky and Yermak have been a team. They're bound at the hip. I remember reading articles just a few months ago about how they even sleep sometimes in the same room. If Yermak goes, the entire basis upon which Zelensky has constructed his system in Kiev will have lost its foundations. And he himself, it will be difficult to avoid the conclusion that he himself, Zelensky, will be tottering towards his fall. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish the program today. We're certainly looking at interesting times in Ukraine. But anyway, this is where I finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. And also now, of course, our Substack site, where, by the way, I've also been writing articles recently. You can also, please remember, if you want to support our work, to check out Patreon and Subscribestar, and do definitely give a look at our shop. Last but not least, please remember, if you've liked this video, again, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.